Welcome, friends. James Corbett here from CorbettReport.com, coming to you on the 5th of December, 2011. And of course, we are joined once again today by our regular weekly guest, Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster at theinternationalforecaster.com. So, Bob Chapman, it's always great to have you on the program. And tonight is one of those nights where, well, we start with a bit of retrospection, because as it's often been noted, without a knowledge of history, we are unfortunately doomed to repeat our mistakes. And this week offers us a chance for such a reflection, coming up on the 70th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack on December 7th, 1941. And I'm not sure if you saw, but this week there was a report from U.S. News and World Report, declassified memo hinted of 1941 Hawaii attack, which says that 3 days before the December 7th, 1941 Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt was warned in a memo from Naval Intelligence that Tokyo's military and spy network was focused on Hawaii, a new and eerie reminder of FDR's failure to act on a basketload of tips that war was near. And I think both you and I, and probably most of the audience, knows that that failure to act was no failure at all, but an intentional missing of that intelligence. But perhaps you can tell us a little bit about your perspective of December 7th, 1941.
I was 6 years old, so I remembered very distinctly. And we all know what it led up to. But in the olden days, the United States government used to conscript people, and they called it a selective service, and they would take people into the military, usually for 2 years, and sometimes you were given the choice of which branch you wanted to go into. And I was contacted by the military because they had been going through the IQ records at the universities, trying to pick out the young people, in this case it was all men, who had high IQs. And they contacted me and they said, look, you're going to have to go in anyway. And we get this super-duper job for you. And I said, well, what's that? And they said, well, we have openings for spooks. And I said, what, like Casper the Ghost? And the guy laughed and he said, no. He said, in what they call the Army Security Agency, and what we do is we spy on our enemies, our potential enemies. And he explained what went on doing that. So I said, all right, I'll come down and talk to you. So I joined for 3 years, and I was in counterintelligence. And as soon as I got involved in training in espionage, it was brought to my attention a book called The War in Ether, The War in the Airwaves. And what had happened is that the British and the U.S. naval intelligence operations had broken the codes of the Japanese diplomatic corps. And that's something later I was involved in, as well as other things I won't go into. And so what that book said was, oh, we had the codes broken. We know when they were coming. And we kind of invited them in to bomb the ships. That's why we lined them up, so that we can get in the war. A matter of fact. So I knew over 70 years ago. And that information first was declassified in September of 1967. Nobody ever paid any attention to it. Even some of the books I read on the subject never even mentioned it. And these were by admirals, and looking back as to what happened. I was not aware that U.S. News and World Report had published such a declassified document here in the last couple of weeks, but it bears out exactly what I've known for years and years. And I would speak about it, I would write about it, and everybody would look at me aghast. I mean, FDR wouldn't do such a terrible thing. And, you know, governments have been doing this sort of thing for hundreds of years. Of course, the way it's been done has been different because of different times. This is close, I think, to, in a way, the Versailles Treaty. That was a treaty that was signed between Germany, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Western nations that were able to make Germany surrender, and Germany was blamed for the whole war. And they made this treaty, and it involved reparations, which means you caused all this damage, so you got to pay for it. And there was a book written by General Leon de Grelle, who has long since been deceased. And excuse me, the name of the book is Hitler at Versailles, and it points out that Versailles was really the beginning of World War II. By forcing the reparations on the Germans, what happened was that you had a Weimar Republic, which was put in place by the Western powers that couldn't handle a financial situation, and we had those 3 years of classic hyperinflation. And in that time, during the 1920s, and most people are not aware of, but there were hundreds of armies within Germany. Armies. Some of them were 50 people and some were several thousand. And they were each cohorts, the groups that worked together very often. And they didn't want foreigners coming in and invading their country, which they thought would happen. Well, anyway, what happened during the 1920s and 30s, Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini were financed from the West. MI6, and this is perhaps 9 months ago, this was released by the British, that they funded Benito Mussolini. He was one of their agents. And over the past number of years, it's come to light that part of the financing of Adolf Hitler came from mainly the United States, some from Britain, and the remainder from Germany. And so why am I telling you this separate story? Because it proves a point that the machinations that you see that have or very often lead to war are something that are created by groups of people, either in or behind government. And we didn't find out about the financing of Adolf Hitler by the Bush family predecessors until after the Second World War. And we didn't find out about Mussolini until just recently. And so you have all of these terrible things going on that the average person says, no, people can't be that evil. I mean, hundreds of millions of people have died in these wars. They wouldn't do that. Well, of course, they do it. And they don't care about human life as long as it's not their own. And so it is, you have to look at every event from both sides of the spectrum. Who are the planners? Who are the financiers? What are the groups involved? And then you can find out what's really going on. The real problem is that people usually never get exposed to this kind of information. And even when they do, they say, gee, that couldn't have happened. And they're wrong. It did happen. And I'm glad that people are writing about it and codifying it, because history will want to know it, because there will be people like you and I who get into the history of why things happen. And that's very important for civilization, because it allows people to understand that for centuries there have been groups that have worked together to bring about chaos, changes of government, suppression of peoples, and, as we find out in these latter years, the curtailment of population. And if you read the tomes by these different organizations, such as the Council on Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission and Bilderberger Groups, the Illuminati, you'll find that they want to get rid of 60 to 80% of the people on the face of the earth because they're useless eaters, as far as they're concerned. So these kind of events, you've got to look behind them. And I hope that over this week that some of these major publications like U.S. News and World Report will bring out information like that, because FDR was a bad guy. He allowed that to happen. Why? Because all the Keynesian economics that was being used during the 1930s to take the United States out of its depression were a total failure. I mean, unemployment in 1940 was 16.2%, and that was better than 39, which was around 17.2%. They weren't getting out. And all that spending as a percentage of GDP was a waste. And they're doing the same thing right now. And why are they doing that? Because they want to take the financial system down, and they want to have another war as a cover. Because they blame the war on the financial and economic failure. And they get away with it. And, of course, there's always the GOAT, which might be Iran, or maybe it'll be Russia and China. We don't know. And when you're dealing with sociopaths who are psychopaths, you get your hands full. And after studying these people for over 50 years, I can tell you that is a mental framework that's very common.
Unfortunately so, but you do raise the idea that it is hopeful that we see the U.S. News and World Report, for example, coming out with this declassified memo, you know, showing some of the foreknowledge of the attack. But unfortunately, if people go and actually read through the article, it is just positing the old incompetence theory that, it was forewarned, but just it was a failure to act instead of what we know was a stand down of defenses in order for the attack to be allowed to happen in order to justify the U.S. involvement in World War II. But I think you're right, it is good to keep this kind of information at least in front of the general public who might be being exposed to it for the first time. But of course, there are numerous other pieces of this puzzle that have come out over the years, including, of course, the infamous front page of the Honolulu Advertiser on November 30th of 1941, which said Japan may strike over weekend. And of course, people don't tend to remember things like that in the aftermath, but then diligent researchers come along and point to all of these things that were going on. And as you say, of course, it was done for a very specific economic reasons and for political power reasons on the part of not just FDR, but of course his cohort, Churchill.
Well, it was to evolve as well, U.S. into the number one position, with England in the number two position. They had been, England had been number one for a long time. But it takes, people to dig these things out, which I do, and friends of mine in the past, G. Edward Griffith, with the creature from Jekyll Island, who's been a friend of mine since 1964, and Gary Allen, who was my partner, who's been deceased for a number of years, and Alan Stang. And these were the people who came after Mrs. Nesta Webster in the 1920s. In fact, during that period of time, secret societies and subversive movements and world revolution, two books that she wrote, were probably the only thing that really explained what was going on at that time in detail. And very few people accessed those books. And today we have others like...
I'm sorry, could you repeat the name and the name of the author and the name of those books for people?
Mrs. N-E-S-T-A, Nesta Webster. And the two books, A World Revolution and Secret Societies and Subversive Movements.
Interesting. Well, I'm certainly going to look into that.
Yeah, and Eustace Mullins, who was a very good friend of mine, who died about a year ago, a little over a year ago, I knew Eustace from the early 1960s, and he did a lot of research into that area before J. Edward Griffin did, and he picked up on it. But and there's John Coleman, who I've known for many years, but I don't talk to him very often, who did a lot of good work. He used to contact me once in a while and ask me about different characters who were on the other side, who I actually knew. And I think he was very frustrated that he didn't get as much information from me as he would like to. But there's lots of things that went on that, you know, people don't know about. You've heard references to after the Second World War was over, there was a rat line created, and people were shipped out of Germany to South America. And that's totally true. I know people who are involved in it. And the U.S. government knew all about it. They took their participants in Operation Paperclip. They picked some of the top Nazis to work in the United States. Americans will never believe that, but it's true. And it's just, it's a long story. But you can see as you look back, if you have the kind of information I have, the whole thing was a setup, World War II. And, you know, after the war was over, a few people were hung, and that supposedly was to make, you know, the Allies happy. And in Japan, there was only one hung. And everybody else got away with it. And I lived in Germany for a long time. I lived all over South America. And I run into these people. And I can tell right away, and they can tell right away, I know what they're all about. But I keep it cool because I don't want to get involved with them.
Indeed. Well, of course, you bring up Eustace Mullins, and I think for some people in the audience, that will raise the specter of the anti-Semitism, which he has been linked with in the popular imagination. Would you like to set the record straight on that issue?
That aspect, more than anything else, was a terrible detriment to him. Because his research work was just excellent. And he, from the very beginning, saw both sides of World War II. And his interviews after the war was over made him the object of vilification by government. I think from my association with him, he was more anti-Zionist than he was anti-Jewish. The concept brought about in 1948 by the Rothschilds to create a Jewish state, which they financed with, among others, I think particularly disturbed him. And one of the things that people don't know and don't understand, and you can look back, there's plenty of now information about this, was that the Germans before World War II were instrumental in helping European Jews establish in what is now Israel, Palestine at that time. And so what you have here is you've got Americans and British financing Germans. Germans worked with the banker Schottky from New York City. He was their minister of, well, we'll call him the Secretary of the Treasury. I forget the word in German. I haven't thought about that word for a long, long time. And they were instrumental in allowing the financing of the movement of Jewish people to the Middle East. And after the negotiations broke down, what happened was that Hitler decided to make them the goat, so to speak, and went on his rampage. But Eustace, I think he was more an anti-Zionist than he was anti-Jewish.
And of course, you talk about how Germany was really instrumental in the creation of the Jewish state in the first place. And it's interesting because now, of course, the old German Nazi ideal of the united Europe is threatening to come true in Europe itself, as unfortunately that ideal transformed into the European Union, which has really scarred the face of Europe for all these decades now. And as we see that project beginning to unravel, or perhaps unravel in a way that's actually a boon to those who are seeking to further entangle Europe in that alliance. We see that there is a EU summit coming up later this week on the 9th in Brussels. There is some chatter. I'm picking up some chatter from various places about this summit and its importance in doing something dramatic, like creating some sort of federalized European central bank mechanism or something of that sort. But what do you think about the plausibility of such a thing at this week's summit?
Well, that's a great segue, but I want to double back, and there's a good reason. After the war, for perhaps 30 or 40 years, I was in contact with many of the top people who were in Germany and had very, very important positions. And I was told by two ex-generals that the German government had been infiltrating whole families of SS people into the Middle East. And that went on for about 6 or 7 years. And most people don't know that. So you have that National Socialist thought process that was very strong at that time, maybe still today for all we know. And I think it's important for people to know that. Of course, the Zionists would scream till they were blue in the face that wasn't the case, but it was. Because I know these people personally who, you know, were involved in that. These weren't privates, these were generals. I decided some time ago that the Keynesian economics model was really a corporatist socialist or corporatist fascist model that was laid out by Keynes. And the 1930s was a trial run for what we see today. The communists were financed from London and from New York, but mostly from London. From its very inception, between the Bolsheviks and the other group, I can't think of the name right now, Mensheviks. The Mensheviks lost. The Bolsheviks got shipped out of Basel. Through Germany. They let them go right through Germany. Hey, well, let's get rid of these guys and send them to Russia. And then they were financed from New York. And many of them left by boat from New York as well. And so this whole thing of communism, socialism, fascism was all dreamt up by the people from behind the scenes. So that was a trial run, as far as I was concerned, for world corporatist fascist government. And that's what we're getting in America today. And now to refer to your question, which is about what's going on over there, you're absolutely correct. Now, what are they after here? They're using debt crisis in order to implement something else. Now, how is the debt crisis going to be handled? Well, in the final analysis, why is Mr. Geithner going to be with all the heads of state this week in Germany? Prior to the meeting on the 8th and the 9th, he's going to give them marching orders. because the U.S. Federal Reserve is going to supply all the money that they could want on the short to intermediate term to deal with the problems that have manifested themselves in six countries, in particular in Europe. So what does that leave the likes of the other heads of state, technocrats, which are bankers, and bureaucrats? And bureaucrats are probably the most insidious. They're all going to get together, and what they're going to try to do, and probably will be successful in spite of what constituents want, they are going to formulate and make happen the ESM, European Stabilization Mechanism, run by eight people, and it's going to be out of Luxembourg, not Brussels. And they will be joined by 17, we'll call them secretaries of the treasuries for each country involved. And they will have carte blanche to do whatever they want, spend as much money as they want, and they can never, and this is in this treaty that they're trying to get passed, they will never be held to account for whatever they do. And what it is the physical operation of budget and fiscal matters in each state by this group of eight and the group of 17 with them. And this ESM is calculated to finally break down the sovereignty of the 17 states, because once you give up your ability to run the finances of your country or use another a currency rather than your own, your sovereignty is lost. And then you become very malleable to those who want to manipulate your country. And bringing us together is a long-term dream of a united Europe run from behind the scenes from the people who caused all the problems in the first place to bring about what you're seeing today. The whole thing's a setup. And so they'll probably get away with it. But the financial aspect of it is not going to work. And they know that. And that's why they had these wars lined up. And then they had their war. And all of the problems get blamed on the war. And historically, they got away scot-free. It's not going to happen this time. Because too many people know what they're doing. And that's come about through programs like this, talk radio, worldwide, and the internet. And they never dreamed that the public would catch up with them. Not everybody, but you don't need everybody. I mean, throughout the world, on average, 50 to 60% of the people are functionally illiterate. So what are you going to do with them? Well, that's why these people have wars. They get rid of them. And the remainder of what we're interested, the people who can think and want to think. And so these are the directions that we're going in, and that's what these meetings are all about, the solidification of the Nazification, if such a word exists, of Europe. That's what they're up to, and there's very few people who can see it. Why? Because they didn't do their homework. That's why. They only can go so far, and it stops, because they never really understand who the bad guys are and why they're doing what they're doing.
Exactly right. Well, if Nazify is not a verb, it certainly should be one, because it perfectly describes the situation. And as I say, there is actually historical continuity there between the German ideal of a united Europe and what the EU has evolved into. And that's, I mean, there are documents going back to the last days of the Nazi regime talking about how they were going to basically ensconce themselves in the European business community and try to hammer things out that way. So again, I think it is absolutely a key descriptor of what's happening. But you talk about something that we've talked about several times now in our conversations, and that's the idea that the coming wars can be used to blame the collapse of the market. And something that I find Particularly worrying in that regard is the fact that, as I understand it, the American markets are again today being propped up artificially higher than they should be. And it seems to me that the only way that this gambit can continue to work, with them continuing to run up the markets much higher than they actually should be, is if they're actually planning on a crash. And the only way that I see them being able to deflect the fallout from that crash is to say it was obviously because of this great terror attack or this war or whatever it is they have up their sleeve. So it seems to me that when they run up the markets like this, it's a time of instability and perhaps even danger.
Well, they build a buffer zone. You know, I was in the markets for 53 years, and I own my own brokerage firm, and so I was in Wall Street almost 30 years, and so I know what they're up to. But if you weren't there and you didn't work your way through it, you couldn't possibly understand what they're up to financially. And many of the commentators try to, but they only can go so far. It's like the issue of history. This is the issue of the internals of the market itself. And what they're doing here is building a buffer zone. Maybe they can get the Dow up to 14,200 again. And then all of a sudden, you have the, perhaps, this is hypothetical, you have American planes flying over Syria, and they drop some bombs, and all of a sudden the Russian planes go up and blow them out of the sky. And that's an act of war. And that means the stock market will go down. And better the market should go down from 14,200 or 12,500 than from a lower number. And they manipulate the market every single day legally, the President's Working Group on Financial Markets. And that's got to be stopped. But the only way we're going to stop them is to have them to open the window of opportunity for us. And I promise you they will. And they know that. These people are not stupid. They may be insane, but they're not stupid. And I would expect that if that sort of thing happened, that the market would probably fall to 8,000 or 9,000 on the Dow, maybe even down to 6,600, rather than going to 1,200 or 2,500 or 3,000. And you can see what they're doing in the market now. I used to be a trader. I was for 25 years. I was a tape reader. I knew all the symbols. Today they give you the names. They make it simple for you. But markets have rhythms. And they're art forms. And it has nothing to do with technology or technical things. Those only happen after the fact. So what you have to do is see fundamentally what's going on and back in to the answers. And that's what I do. And so that's why the market is being built up in here, because I think something nasty is going to happen.
Well, I think we're all bracing for that something nasty to happen. But you mentioned there the window of opportunity, that they're going to have to leave a window of opportunity open before they can really act. What do you mean by that? And what is that window? And how can we access it?
They have to, and they want to, take the system down. They want to destroy the system as it stands. And then they will essentially own everything. And then they'll build a new system, which they'll run. And nobody will think that it's unusual that they have created the chaos, they created the basics for the collapse of the system, and now after having done all of that, which was wrong, bad, whatever, they're going to run the system again. And that's what they're up to. And it's a suppression and enslavement of people is the final analysis. I mean, look at Egypt, look at Rome, and so on. Every great empire, that's what they've done. It's nothing new. And it's planned that way by these people. And who are they? Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberger Group, and the Royal Society in London, the Illuminati. These people are all interconnected worldwide. And so that is what they're up to. So the window of opportunity opens when the financial structure collapses. And they'll be the ones to pull the plug. And then they want to form that new system. And it's up to us who understand what's going on to let the people know that is how they intend to recapture the system and subject us. And there's a whole parcel of things that go along with that. And if we can convince the people at that time that that's what they were up to and that's what they did, their power will be taken away from them, because their power is the seat, the key, is a banking system. And they continue to do this from generation to generation. And people look at it historically as something that's cyclical, that happens within economic and financial structures. And in part, that's true. But what's really true is they made it happen over and over again. And if you read history, it's all there for you.
Once again, history is the guide that we can use to sort through this morass of information that seems contradictory at times. It seems difficult to get through, but without a knowledge of history, we'll never really understand what's happening or be able to parse all of this information. So finally tonight, I would like to get your take on the Republican presidential primaries. And of course, we've seen the precipitous collapse of Michelle Bachmann as a potential frontrunner for the Republican candidates, and the collapse of Rick Perry, and the collapse now of Herman Cain. And as much as the mainstream media absolutely hates and abhors this fact, Ron Paul is really now clearly at least the second front runner in the entire campaign, behind unlikely Newt Gingrich of all people. So what do you think about the Ron Paul campaign and its chances from here until the primaries really kick out?
Gingrich is morally corrupt and a member of all of those organizations I just mentioned. He's essentially a whoremonger, as is Mr. Cain. And there's nothing to change that. They are what they are. And Cain is part of the establishment from behind the scenes. You don't get to be on the board of a Federal Reserve Bank if you're not one of them. And the background of Mr. Perry, I don't even want to go into it, so sordid. He's unelectable. So it's between Romney and Paul. And Romney has the full system behind him. He'll have billions of dollars to spend, and they will try greatly to get him elected. If Ron Paul is not elected, what will happen is that America will plunge very quickly into a state of control by government, federal government, and perhaps even martial law. There'll probably be an event where the United States will become currency blocked. People will be limited in who can travel outside the country. There will be all sorts of things. I'm not going to go into them all because there's plenty of them that they're going to implement. Paul can stop that, at least temporarily. And so his running mate would be very, very important. He's 2 months older than I am, and I know how I feel in good health at this age, and so I know how he must feel. And he could probably do a good solid 4 years, maybe more, but that's pretty difficult at that age, because you know, everything starts breaking down. We're only supposed to live for so long, even if we live properly. I think he could turn America around, turn it in the right direction, and all I can say is, if he's not elected, God help you. Because what these people got planned for you, you don't want to even hear. And if you don't elect him and people like him, you can kiss it goodbye for generations of your progeny to come, because they're going for everything this time. And that's why when they open up that window of opportunity, we got to slip in there and make the difference. And if we don't, then the only possibility left is revolution. And you don't want to have to do that, because it's not nice.
That's unfortunately about the size of it. We either sneak out the window or we break through it. But either way, we've got to get out there. So so part of that, of course, is informing ourselves. And as much as we talk each week and as much as we cover such a wide range of topics, it only scratches the surface of the information that's contained in the International Forecaster, of course, which comes out twice a week. So why don't you tell people a little bit about the newsletter and how they can get their hands on it?
The International Forecaster is about business, finance, economic, social, and political issues all over the world. We've been publishing on Wednesdays and Saturdays via the internet for 23 years, and we have about 35 to 40 pages in each issue each week. We have a hard copy that goes out twice a month for those who are not on the internet. And everything that you need to know each week is in that publication. You can get a free introductory copy by going to theinternationalforecaster.com. The International, FORECASTER.com. You can also go to www.intforecaster.com, intforecaster.com. For those of you who'd like to ask a question, we answer everyone, or would like a copy, or would like a copy of our latest report on gold and silver shares, you can email us, and that address is Bob, B-O-B, at intforecaster.com, Bob at intforecaster.com. And for those of you who would like to call toll-free, that number is 877-479-8178. That's 877-479-8178. You can get copies of the report there. And for those of you who would like to become subscribers, they have a special offer there for a free one-year subscription. The offer's terrific. Take advantage of it.
Excellent. Well, on that note, let's leave it there, Bob Chapman. Another fascinating conversation and one of many, many, many more to come, I hope, as we continue having these weekly Monday conversations here on CorbettReport.com. So, Bob Chapman, thank you so much for your time again today.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you all for listening.